the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning our Resilient Youth series continues with Samantha Walsh, a social worker at Park City High School. She supports juniors and seniors through their most formative years and leads the Hope Squad, students helping students by building connection and raising awareness. Resilient Youth is underwritten by Live Like Sam. Then neuroscientist and best-selling author Dr. Daniel Levitin joins us to explore how music heals the mind and body. It's all in his book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord. From ancient traditions to modern neuroscience, Levitin reveals why rhythm and melody remain among humanity's oldest medicines. We'll discover how music is helping treat conditions from depression to Alzheimer's and why it may be one of today's most powerful therapies. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My next guest is Samantha, or Sam, Walsh. She's a school social worker at Park City High School, supporting students through individual, group, and family counseling. She also helps ninth graders and new students transition into high school through this student-led program called the Hope Squad. She facilitates weekly leadership team meetings and that build community and connection. Beyond the school, she collaborates with mental health providers, the court system, and local agencies to ensure students have the support they need. As a board member and gala chair for the Live Like Sam Foundation, she extends her dedication to youth well-being into the broader community. She joins me now for our monthly Resilient Youth episode. It's a partnership with Live Like Sam. Sam Walsh, welcome back to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here, Lynn.
Great to have you because you have such a pulse on what's going on in our community with kids. And, you know, I just want to start this conversation off. We have something really new and big happening this year, and that is locked cell phones, locked away into the little bag.
The yonder pouch.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I just wanted to ask you how that is going, how students are receiving it, how parents are receiving it.
Yeah, great question, Lynn. And this is new for me. I know they had yonder pouches on a trial basis at Treasure Mountain last year. So it's the first year of rollout here at the high school. And that just took effect about a week ago. And prior to that, students and parents were very concerned, very anxious about what that change would be about, you know, giving up those devices during the school day, because many of our youth are on those screens throughout the day, and it's really just kind of become a coping tool for youth. So I think students and parents were really concerned that not having access was gonna lead to anxiety. And we're only a week in, but I think it is such a great break that we're giving to our teenagers and our young people, a break from the real pressures that are out there with social media of like comparison culture and seeing what other people are doing, or if, you know, students' friends are doing things socially without them, that left out problem and so many issues with cyberbullying and harassment. I just think what a nice break that they get to come to school and kind of set aside those social and comparison pressures so that they can really truly engage with their peers and their friends and their education. So I'm so happy to see youth getting that break. So far, so good. I haven't heard too many complaints since we've actually rolled it out. So I think it's just such a positive thing for all.
Really interesting that you haven't heard too many complaints. I suppose if there are special cases in which a student maybe comes to you and says, I get it and I'm in support, but I need to call my parent for XYZ reason. Are they now doing like you and I did when we were in high school? You go to the office and pick up the landline and call?
Yeah, sort of yes, sort of no. We do allow students, if they do need to contact home, they can certainly come to the office and use the landline. But if students come to the main office or the counseling office, we will allow them, we can unlock their phones and give them a private space to have a conversation, because certainly we understand there are those circumstances where students do need to reach home, or the parent needs to reach their child, they can contact the main office or the counseling office, and we will facilitate that communication. One of the big concerns that I've been hearing, besides my child doesn't have access to call me, and we're, you know, as a parent, and we're assuring them that they do, is, you know, just with this culture of concern about school violence, which, you know, obviously is huge in our world, unfortunately, and really on the hearts and minds of our young people. You know, it pains me as an adult and as a parent to know that high schoolers do worry about school violence, and that's a really real thing in our world. But I love what our principal, Caleb Fine, says, is that the truth is, if we were in some kind of school violence or tragedy situation, many of the phone lines would be down, and, you know, having access to that phone wouldn't necessarily be a saving grace. But certainly if we were in an emergency, you can actually tear open that Yonder pouch and get to your phone. But these are realities of the world we're living in, that young people have a lot of anxiety and concern over things that they're seeing out there in our world right now.
That is certainly something you and I didn't have to contend with when we were in high school, right? Sure. It's a real tragedy. And, you know, along those lines, how are we making Park City High School safer for our children? So this isn't even a question, or shouldn't be a question.
Yeah, well, I think the school district's done a really good job of hardening the exteriors, you know, with film on the windows that are shatterproof, and putting up fences. But I like to look at prevention from the inside, mm-hmm. of having the heart and mind of young people and caring. And I know that our teachers in our district really care and have very positive relationships with our students. I've experienced that as a parent. And I believe our teachers and our students keep each other safe, like through the Hope Squad, training peers, training young people to be good friends and to watch out for warning signs. I truly think that's how we keep everyone safe, is noticing when something's not right or someone's struggling and getting them the support and help that they need.
Absolutely. Sam Walsh, you have been, you used to be called an intervention counselor, and now you're called the school social worker, because, as I understand, each school now has a school social worker in the district.
Correct.
You've been doing this a long time. How long?
Yeah, this is my 18th year, and I'm just so privileged to come back to work here at the high school every year with our students. I feel like I've learned so much from our amazing youth. I just am privileged to spend time with them and work on skills of how to cope with life and how to be a healthy person. I feel just so passionately about helping young people with their identity and finding their way into adulthood. It really just kind of feeds me and fuels me. And the young people are just so hopeful. They give me hope about the world every single day when I come to work. So it keeps me coming back year after year.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. 10,000 foot view from 18 years ago to now. How have the challenges changed, evolved, lessened for our young people? I mean, we hear so much negativity in the news media about what's going on with our youth. But I know through working with Live Like Sam that there is a lot of hope, and there's a lot of wonderful things going on, and maybe we just hear the negativity.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I know the negative that we definitely hear about, unfortunately, is just the mental health crisis facing young people today. And I think that really got highlighted in, you know, through the COVID-19 pandemic. I think with the rise of cell phones and smartphones, we've seen that increase in social media bullying, harassment, unhealthy coping tools that are shared out there on social media. But 76% of students have moderate to high depressive symptoms, and 53% have moderate to high mental health needs. That is just blows me away every time I read that. That's a Utah statistic. So I think mental health concerns have grown as we've had other influences out there in the world impacting our young people that never before we had to face, kind of like I talked with you earlier about that comparison culture with social media, just that digital presence and ability to have access to sometimes positive and sometimes really negative content and influencers. People are influencing my kids. People are influencing your kids. Some of that influencing is for the good and some of it not so much. And that's why I feel so personally drawn to the mission of the Live Like Sam Foundation, is that we want every young person to successfully navigate adolescence and become a young adult that knows who they are, is secure in who they are. They have character, they have goals and values, and they have the tools to navigate the stress and all the noise in the world. So I just... even though I'm a busy woman, I'm trying to help the teens of Park City, I felt compelled to do more because Live Like Sam is the only program out there offering these tier two skills that all kids, every single kid in the world needs these skills of who am I? What do I value? How do I live my best life with zest, with goals? And how do I cope with big stress, with positive stress? How do I tune out noise or things that are harmful and still overcome when I'm struggling? I think that that's what we want for all of our kids. So for me to not jump on board with what Live Like Sam is doing would be, I just think, super hypocritical because I know as a parent, my own kids have gone through the programming with Live Like Sam. And even as a social worker, even as a counselor for all these years, I've seen my own children struggle with whether it's mental health or social issues. And there is more influence out there than just what's going on in our home and with our parenting. And I need other role models out there, other mentors, and other positive information going towards my kids and helping complete who they are as a person. I cannot do that job alone. So I'm very passionate about what Live Like Sam is doing to create these positive spaces, belonging, helping kids be kind. Boy, don't we want to turn on the TV and see more of that, right?
Yeah. Well, it's really nice to know that we have this great partnership in the community. And I also understand you are the gala director. That sounds like something completely out of your wheelhouse. But the Live Like Sam gala is coming up. And my understanding is that it's sold out. But let's hear more about what you're raising money for and what your job is the gala chair. Okay.
It's just kind of guiding all of our efforts to host our annual fundraiser. It's our one annual fundraiser that basically supports all of our mental well-being programming for young people in Summit and Wasatch counties. We have core programming that is for elementary students. We have Thrive, which is for grades 6 through 12. Digital wellness, our challenge accepted in our Sage and Seekers. So all of our proceeds from our silent and live auction and giving opportunities at the gala fund these programs. And we've reached over 4,000 local youth with our programming, and we're not going to stop there. Live Like Sam has decided, instead of expanding to other communities outside of Wasatch and Summit County, we're going to go deep. We're going to make sure all of our young people have been touched with this, you know, important message that you belong, you matter. We want you to find your place in the world. You know, all teens are going through that developmental stage, according to Erickson, identity versus role confusion. Who am I? Where do I belong? What do I stand for? They're trying on different identities and trying to figure out where to fit in. We want all of our young people to belong and fit in and feel valued here in Summit and Wasatch County. And by teaching resiliency skills and coping skills, we believe that's raising a generation of healthy and well kids that are going to be living their dreams, their hopes and dreams.
So wonderful. You're making me think of a recent Park City Film Series movie called Folk Tales, and it was in Sundance, I think, last year. Incredible film where these students choose a gap year kind of program, but they go to the very northern reaches of Norway near the Russian border, and they, for the school year, learn how to take care of sled dogs, and they learn how to be a sled dog musher, I think they're called, and take care of the sled dogs, and then also learn this skill of resiliency where they have to go out with their one dog and spend several nights out in the cold. It's a phenomenal film that you must see. But what really impacted me about the film is this growing sense of, even though it's hard and even though it's a big struggle to do this, the kids really become resilient. And maybe it's a word that, you know, gets overused, but, you know, it makes me wonder, as a school social worker, what is your definition of a young person who is resilient? You've talked about it a little bit already.
Yeah, and that's such a good question, Lynn. And resilience means so many things. But what I want for, you know, teens and young people is to, and sometimes parents are surprised when I give them this message, I want kids to embrace failure. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a culture sometimes of win, right? Yeah. We want to be on the podium. We want to be the best. We are human. We all fail. And the only way we get to be on the podium or be the winner is embracing failure, learning, growing, coming back at it again. I think somewhere along the way in our parenting trends have shifted. We're trying to pave the way. We're trying to remove obstacles for our kids so that they can get on that podium or be the best in whatever it is they're striving for. But the more we remove the obstacles, we are hindering our young people's ability to overcome the obstacle or to dig in and find that grit to keep going, like the mushers, like they've got to be out there with their dog and they have to solve problems. If we're always solving the problem for our kids and paving the way, they are actually not achieving their developmental goal of who am I? Who am I in the world? How do I navigate these problems and keep going and you know, learn to deal with positive stress or learn to overcome, you know, something traumatic or really difficult. Successful people are able to embrace, I've got a challenge or a problem in my life, but I'm going to be okay either way. Because I know that I have confidence because I had to do things on my own and solve problems and gain that independence. And don't get me wrong, Lynn, I'm a parent of two teenagers, 19 and 16, and we don't want our kids to suffer. And we have to just remind ourselves as parents, if we don't want them to suffer, we need to walk alongside them instead of pave the way and be there when they stumble, but they learn every time they stumble and they learn every time they have to ask themselves, what do I do now that, you know, I had a failure or something went wrong? We need to get better at asking our kids, hey, what do you think you should do about that situation, versus always swooping in? Because we know, Lynn, we have the right answer, right? We have the best way to solve it, but that might not be the way our child wants to solve it. So we need to empower them to solve their issues and to seek support. And I know that's a fine balance. I know as a parent, I've tried to control my kids or control what they're doing, but that isn't what they need as a teen. Mm-hmm. They need us to take a step back and ask them and have them take ownership in their life and responsibility and try it on their own and to believe in them that they can solve their own problems, because they can. They're amazing. They're so much more resilient. And you asked a while ago, and I forgot to answer, you said, what are some of the positives? This generation is so resilient and amazing. They see seeking help and support for mental health and mental well-being so positively. They know that that is what healthy people do. And that is not something that's true about our generation still, Lynn, to
true.
This day. I am so impressed with young people's ability to say, I'm not okay. I don't have this. I need to go talk to my school counselor, my teacher, my social worker. And they value that collaboration and sharing obstacles. So that in and of itself is a resiliency skill, saying, I don't have this figured out. I need help and support. That is what healthy people do to navigate the world. So that gives me so much hope every day. And it gives me so much hope that Live Like Sam's mission is to make sure that all young people have those skills, but also they're getting those peer mentors and hearing the message from someone else besides parents, because we can't do this important work alone.
Yeah. Finding that one peer mentor, finding that one person is so important. That was also a point in that Folktales movie that I saw, you know, these two boys that just never really felt a sense of belonging anywhere. They found each other and they become great pals. And it gave each of them just such a boost. So finding that one person is so important.
Absolutely. That peer piece is so important for teens' identity development, that to find a way or find a group of peers that they relate to and that they can get feedback from is really successful to navigating adolescence.
We spoke recently to a digital wellness professional, national. She was talking about, you know, these school bans on cell phones during the school day, and talking about how we really need to prepare our students way ahead of time. So you've talked about what we can do to help our children become more resilient. You outside them, don't wait, pave the way for them. That's such a great thing to listen to. What can parents of younger children be doing now to prepare them for, you know, not being addicted to the cell phone and to social media?
Yeah, I think that's also a great question. I know I've seen studies that say holding off on getting your kid a cell phone until the age of 12 is really good to protect their brains from that dopamine hit that they get from that instant feedback. I think getting your kids involved in programs like Live Like Sam, where they're participating in core programming, where kids are developing real resilience skills, friendship and kindness skills. You know, when we think about elementary age youth is just that social play, it's such a great time for prevention, that most prevention efforts, whether we're talking about cell phone use, substances, mental health, it's all the same, that you really need to be having these conversations with young people, you know, by the age of 9 or 10, right? So it is not too early to have developmentally appropriate conversations with your elementary students about technology, cell phones, social media, what your family values are around not just technology, but substance use, drinking alcohol, using recreational drugs. That's kind of an on-the-job learning parenting skill I've learned being here. And, you know, I talk to my kids about it and it feels silly. Like, why am I talking to them about drugs and alcohol? They're little, they're cute. They're just playing on the playground with their friends. But you have to educate them before they're offered or in that situation so that they feel confident, so they feel sure of what the expectations are. And that's you helping them develop that resilience to say, hey, I'm not into that. You know, I'm not doing that until this age, or my family value is we don't do that, and helping instill that confidence. Talk to your kids as young as possible. Get them involved in positive programming like Live Like Sam. It's not too young. It's definitely not too young. Kids know more than we think they do, because they do have so much access. I think it's really critical that we bring them into the conversation instead of keeping them out of it.
One of the things that I really think is so valuable about Live Like Sam, we've talked a lot in this interview about negativity and positivity, is Live Like Sam was founded with this wonderful human being who had so much positivity in his life, Sam Jackenthal. Of course, We all know he tragically passed away, but it is a celebration of the positive things that Sam was and how we go out into our greater community and spread that positivity and how we can all embody what Sam did in his short life. And really, it was very infectious who Sam Jackenthal was. And so it's interesting because we do have a lot of groups that are kind of founded on things that may not feel so positive, like we're going because there's an issue, there's a problem, there's a struggle, there's a challenge. Yeah. But I hadn't thought about that before until you were talking, but.
Yeah. That Live Like Sam, and we're at the 10-year anniversary of Sam's passing now, so it's a special year for us, but we're so honored to deliver positive programming from positive psychology. And our programs look at what's going right with our young people, and let's build upon that versus what's wrong. So all young people have the ability to learn coping skills, to navigate life's challenges, whether that's mental health or bullying or life problems. All kids can develop tools to be resilient regardless of those negative things. But we're coming at it from a positive research base of what works and what builds healthy minds and healthy adults. So that's just such a privilege to come at it from such a positive view, from Sam's legacy of being that kind, driven, dedicated friend and athlete. What great character strengths we're trying to pass on to our community in all trying to live a little bit more like Sam.
Yes. Well, Sam Walsh, Samantha Walsh, it's so great to speak with you. Always my guest. Sam Walsh is a school social worker, and she's also the board chair of the upcoming Live Like Sam Gala. And what can folks do, because it is sold out, what can they do at this last moment?
So you can go on to our website at Live Like Sam Foundation. You can give, you can contribute without attending, whether that's an in-kind donation from your business for our gala, or if you would just like to contribute. We also always are looking for volunteers to help us with our mission out in the community, and have lots of volunteer opportunities, as well as we'd love for you to familiarize yourselves with our different programming options for young people. We also have a Sage and Seekers program where adults in their 60s are paired with an 8th grade through 12th grader, and they're kind of bridging a gap between the generations. We have so many ways for you to get involved and support our mission. We'd love you to check us out at livelikesamfoundation.org.
Words well spoken. Sam Walsh, thank you so much for joining me today on The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much, Lynn, for having me.
Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Our next guest is neuroscientist and New York Times bestselling author Daniel Levitin. Mr. Levitin reveals the deep connections between music and healing. Music is one of humanity's oldest medicines, from the Far East to the Ottoman Empire, Europe to Africa and the pre-colonial Americas. Many cultures have developed their own rich traditions for using sound and rhythm to ease suffering, promote healing, and calm the mind.
In his latest work, Daniel Levitin explores the curative powers of music, showing us how and why it's one of the most potent therapies today. He brings together the results of numerous studies on music and the brain, demonstrating how music can contribute to the treatment of a host of ailments, from neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's to cognitive injury, depression, and pain. Daniel Levitin, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me, Lynn. Mary Beth.
First of all, the title of your book, I heard there was a secret chord. Of course, everyone recognizes that as the lyric from Leonard Cohen's beloved song, Hallelujah. And it creates a really nice way to open this conversation, I think, with that metaphor between this, you might call the secret chord. What is that secret chord for you?
Well, to bring it back to the title of the book, Cohen's lyric comes from a passage in the Old Testament, of course, where King Saul, who was given to fits of depression, would summon a young David who had skills playing the lyre. And when David played the lyre, it would soothe Saul and bring him back to being able to govern the country. David, by the way, is the same David who slew the giant Goliath with a rock. So he wasn't, you might say it was the first instance of rock music. The key, though, is I think Leonard Cohen and the biblical passage and all of us here probably think of the secret chord as a metaphor, or maybe there are different secret chords for different people, but there isn't one magic chord like in the film E.T. that's going to unlock the secrets of the universe and help us communicate with extraterrestrials. The secret chord is personal. Music is personal. It's very intimate.
Yes. Well, you, as both a neuroscientist and a musician, no doubt have your own secret chord that is evolving the more you study music's effect on the brain and its healing powers. It seems perhaps in the years that you've been studying this, you, as one of the scientists creating the data and doing the research, you're finding a little bit more solid research that shows the music's effect. What is your most recent finding that excites you to no end?
Well, so thank you for setting up that history, Lynn. The field has been collecting data, I mean, since the beginning of time. You could call David and Saul data, or at least a story, not a controlled experiment. But it's only in the last 10 years or so that scientists around the world have applied the scientific method to study, you know, consistently and rigorously to understand the effects of music on the brain, the mind, the body, and whatever curative and therapeutic powers it may have. And really the one that excites me the most, I think, is the Parkinson's story that you led off the segment with, mentioning. The problem that many Parkinson's patients face is that due to degradation of circuits in the basal ganglia, they reach a point where they're unable to walk. And the reason is because the timing circuits in the brain that allow them to put one foot in front of the other at exactly the right time, so you don't end up with both feet in the air at the same time or both feet stuck on the ground, you have to alternate in order to walk. Those circuits are degraded, the timing part of it. But we can listen to music, they can listen to music, with the tempo that's the same as their normal walking speed, their gait. And as soon as that tempo comes from music, there are entire populations of neurons in the brain that synchronize with it. They're preserved, and they basically kickstart the system, jumpstart the system, so that the patients can walk again. And they can undergo a program of rhythmic auditory stimulation therapy where they listen to precisely tempoed music for maybe 20 minutes a day for a few weeks. And after that, they don't need the music at all anymore. They've built up new neural capacity. That's exciting because being able to move, we take for granted until we lose it.
Yeah, we sure do. I thought it was really interesting in your book about how you were helping Joni Mitchell after her aneurysm a decade ago, and creating these collaborative playlists with her really seemed to help her recovery dramatically, which is such a gift to the world to give her extra time. So thank you for that.
Well, it was entirely selfish. I mean, I love Joni Mitchell and I love Joni's music. And going back to the 90s when we met, the idea of there not being any more Joni in the world really depressed me. And so it was entirely a selfish motivation.
Well, it is very depressing and distressing to think about no more Joni music. And I wondered, I have people with Alzheimer's in my life, and I was wondering if you have recommendations for just how the average person or caregiver might create a similarly potent playlist for the people in their lives, just to create kind of casual therapy at home.
Yeah, so Joni, because she has this sort of magically prescient life, back in 2002 or so, had worked with the Starbucks record label to curate her Desert Island Discs, basically, her favorite songs. And she asked me to help her to co-produce that CD. So I knew that it, you know, what it was on it and what their thoughts were. And when she was recovering and unable to speak and find herself, those were the songs she had pre-curated for herself and that made her feel alive again. They tended to be songs from her youth. Saturday Night Fish Fry by Lou Jordan, Edith Piaf, some more recent songs, but songs that really touched her core. So the typical thing for people with memory loss or Alzheimer's or recovering from some sort of brain damage is you want to play the music of their youth, not too far back, not like 6 and 8 year old kiddie songs, but say the ages of 12 to 16, time when they were first making their own choices about music, not just accepting what came on, when they were using their own sense of agency to select what music they wanted to hear. And if you don't know enough about a person, you could just look at the whatever hit songs back in the 1940s or the 50s for that period. And what I recommend in the book is that each of us create a little playlist that we attach to our advanced medical directive.
I think that's an excellent idea. We should all put that in the file right now.
What would be on yours?
I would probably have a mix. When I'm doing certain things, I like Baroque music. It puts me in a really good space. I have a massive musical love, but probably Joni's Blue would be on there. Early Van Morrison, even just random things. Vangelis, like depends on what I would want to use it for. If I want to kind of feel inspired, feel relaxed, feel chill, you know. Why do you think it is that age that you mentioned, the kind of 12 to 16, 13 to 18, why is that such a critical time in our lives for how music takes hold and becomes so important to us?
It has to do with the brain, actually, and brain development. So for the first 10 years of life, the primary mission of the brain is to learn as much about the world as possible. And then starting around age 10 to 12, although we never stop learning, the primary mission shifts from just absorbing everything to absorbing things more selectively. And that's when we first begin to realize, around that age of 10 to 12, I don't have to just like the music my parents like. I don't have to like the clothes or the friends that my parents like. I can make my own choices. We are becoming a personality. And during those early preteen and early teen years, we're trying on different things, see what fits. We hang out with different kids. We, in our schools, we associate with different kinds of playmates. We try on different kinds of haircuts or clothing styles or jewelry or whatever it is that's the fashion and see what fits for us. To a large degree, our musical tastes at that time might be influenced by our social group. You go to any high school campus and it's almost certain that the kids in the chess club are listening to different music than the football players. And it's kind of a mark of identity. And then there are always the disaffected, alienated kids who have their own music. And so we discover what works for us. And that becomes really woven into our personality, our developing sense of self.
You know, it's going back to this age between, say, 10 and 20. You know, I was thinking as you were talking about how our brains aren't developed fully until we're, 25 or so. And so
I'm not sure mine is even still now.
Yeah, we could all have various arguments about that. But it's interesting that then the time in your life that your brain records music to the fullest is a time in your life when your brain's not fully developed. But then what you were talking about is more, it's more an emotional thing than a cognitive thing. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's such an interesting observation, Lynn. So music has a privileged position in that 10 to 20 time. And the part of the brain that isn't fully developed to your 25 is the prefrontal cortex, the part that's responsible for inhibition control and planning and being responsible. And so there are actual arguments playing out in courtrooms across the country where a 22-year-old did something awful and the defense is, well, he or she couldn't control themselves because their prefrontal cortex that is in charge of inhibition and being a citizen and behaving well, that wasn't fully developed yet. You know, you wouldn't punish a 6-year-old like you would a 30-year-old. Doesn't mean you shouldn't hold them accountable. It's just a matter of the nature of the punishment, I think.
Well, my first crush was when I was 4 years old. I had a major crush on Glen Campbell.
Ooh. You know, it's not funny. And his electric hair.
Oh, I just loved Glen Campbell. And you talk about him because, as many of our listeners probably know, he died from complications relating to Alzheimer's. And yet you talk about a concert he gave, the last concert he gave, where you could see that his brain was alive with the music that he performed, but otherwise it was gone. Can you tell us more?
When Glenn started noticing that he was having some memory difficulties, he went to see his doctor. They did some tests and ultimately brain scans and discovered that he had Alzheimer's and that parts of his brain responsible for memory had shrunk and other parts had gone offline. And he just, at the time, he thought that it was just that he wasn't remembering things that were unnecessary, which was also true. Part of an expert brain, and an expert musician is no exception, is that experts tend to remember the things that are relevant to them in their areas of expertise, and they let everything else go. That's a matter of neural efficiency and productivity. So there were both things going on. And he decided that he wanted to do one last big tour, even with the Alzheimer's as it progressed, and to film a documentary to document what was happening. And on that very last show in Napa, I had seen the brain scans, and half his brain was not active. But he could still play guitar better than anybody on the planet, and he was still, you know, instructing the sound guy and the band and keeping track of things. You know, he didn't like his guitar sound, and he, you know, messing with it and talking to his technicians about it from the stage while he's playing, and which is normal, of course, but not normal for somebody with Alzheimer's, maybe. But he might play the same song three times in a row, and he might not know what city he was in. So when the music took hold, he had built up across a lifetime so much cognitive reserve that the music was almost entirely intact. With half his brain gone, he could still play songs better than anybody, but he couldn't do much else. Off stage, he didn't know who he was or what to do.
Wow. I thought there was an interesting part. It might have been in that same chapter where you were discussing how in musical therapy, some people who have been largely nonverbal or totally nonverbal are able to sing things in their lives, like, I need a glass of water, or I need to go to the bathroom, and somehow channeling the information through the musical part of their brain allows them to be vocal again. Can you explain a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, the best public example of this is Gabby Giffords, of course. Gabby was a congresswoman who was, during an attempted assassination, was shot in the head, and she lost her ability to speak in what we call aphasia. The speech centers of the brain were damaged by the bullet, the vasculature and all of that were disrupted. And so how do you get her to speak again when the speech centers are gone? Well, it turns out there, as based on work in my lab and other labs, we know that music and speech areas, although they're overlapping, they're distinct circuits in the brain. And so there's a therapy called melodic intonation therapy, where you teach somebody to sing what it is they need to say, because the singing brain is still alive and intact, while the speaking brain is not. And so Gabby would be taught things, as you say, Mary Beth, like, I need a glass of water, or where is the bathroom, or, you know, kind of daily needs kinds of things. I'd like to take a nap. I'm going to lie down now. That part's intact. Even though lyrics are words, musical lyrics are served by a different section of the brain. And so by training over and over again, she was eventually able to scaffold on the intact parts of the brain and now speaks perfectly normally.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? Well, in the very first page of your book, you give the quote, science seeks to find truth in the natural world. Art seeks to find truth in the emotional world. And I think that for me, the whole crux of this fascinating book and all your books is the straddling between art and science and how we can, scaffold those to help each other. And at first, when I was reading about some of the musical mind mapping, I thought, oh, I don't know if I want this to be mapped. I want it to stay mysterious and magical when you have something that moves you and, you know, kind of really penetrates your life in a way that feels indelible. Does that come up for you as you study it? Is the discovery process ever, I don't know, diminishing the mystery that makes music so special for some people?
I had the same worry at first, but it's actually been the opposite. Every time I figure out some small part of the mystery, five new mysteries pop up and they're more glorious than the last. And and actually understanding the complexity of it helps me appreciate the mystery more. It's kind of like I have a friend named Patrick Martin, who's a magician, and he's performed at the White House and on television, and he's a great magician. And every once in a while, he'll reveal to me a little bit about a trick. I mean, he would tell me the whole thing, but I don't want to know because it's so much more fun not knowing. But knowing the little bit about how he did that trick just makes me marvel at it even more. Or, you know, I spent some time with Sting in preparing this book and a couple of the previous ones, and knowing how he sings and plays bass at the same time and how he writes songs, I love his music. Knowing a little bit about how he does it and him knowing a little bit about what's going on in his brain when he does it, I think both of us feel that that's wonderful to know, and it doesn't rob us of mystery, it reinvigorates it, it rekindles it. But it's interesting, you talked about straddling science and art, and I was thinking when you said that, because I haven't had breakfast yet, we tend to think of science and art as these separate, non-overlapping magisteria, and it always surprises us when they come together. But when you're eating food, it doesn't surprise you that much when salty and sweet come together. If you've got this wonderful salty dish and somebody threw in some peach cubes, you think, oh, well, isn't that nice? Or if it's, you know, like couscous and somebody puts in some slivered almonds, so you have the crunchy and the soft. I'm looking at a painting right now that's got contrasting colors and textures. We do that in every other part of our lives.
So true. It's interesting because I'm talking about for the last couple of minutes, you know that there is this tremendous depth of how music affects us, whether it's our health or the way we think or the way we're able to talk. And yet the science that we're bringing along with it is helping us to give more credibility to it. And something I read in your book about getting insurance companies to sign on to saying, yes, sound healing is real and it should be, and it's going to cost an insurer far less to provide this for a patient. Talk a little bit about those efforts, and are there insurance companies out there that are coming along on this?
I started working on this 10 years ago with the NIH when Francis Collins was in charge. He moved over to the White House Science Office, and he and I continued working on this from a bunch of different angles. He's no longer with the White House Science Office in the new administration, but he's back at the NIH, which is defunded. But the idea was, as you say, why spend money on things that are less effective and more expensive? And sort of the model case for this is when you go into surgery, if you're going to require a general anesthetic in the pre-op room, the anesthesiologist will probably give you a benzodiazepine, maybe Valium, because they want you to be physiologically relaxed during the operation, which is different than knocking you out with propofol. Being knocked out and being relaxed are two different things. And they find that recovery rates are better when people are relaxed going in and they're relaxed waking up and all of that. That Valium that you might buy at the corner drugstore for $5, in a hospital in the United States on average, that same pill, $750. That's the profit center for hospitals. It's like booze in a restaurant. What we've seen is studies that show that relaxing music in that same situation is at least as effective as the Valium and much cheaper and no addictive effects. And so why not do that? So far, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of New Jersey are covering music therapy. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and somebody from the governor's office on the day I launched my book in Boston last September, the hardback, I'm now promoting the paperback. When the hardback came out, somebody from the governor's office announced that Massachusetts was giving 10 free vouchers to every citizen for arts therapy, either for therapeutic reasons or preventative reasons. So things are coming along.
That's fantastic. Well, there are so many interesting stories about how music is being discovered to have relationships with wonderful health outcomes. It's always interesting when things that people experience anecdotally start to get a little bit of scientific metrics behind them, because there are always two kinds of folks. Some people need the background credibility, and other people are like, oh, I just feel it, so I know it. What is the feeling that you have when you're hearing a song that is just making you physiologically or mentally healthy? How can, if we're trying to use music for our own mental or physical health, what are the symptoms that we recognize when we're hearing music that can tell us this is a special one for us?
Well, I think it's like anything else. If you feel stressed and you take deep breaths or you meditate, you know whether it's working or not. I think knowing what your therapeutic goal is, or your outcome goal, or if you don't want to call it therapeutic, what your mood goal is. I want to relax. I want to be energized for my exercise workout. Most of us have a pretty good intuition about how that's working. If I'm on the elliptical and I have my music in shuffle mode and a slow ballad comes on, I'll hit skip because I need to be keeping up my pace at 80 steps per minute or whatever it is. So I think part of it is just knowing what state you want to be in. Am I trying to wake up and I'm trying to fall asleep and I'm trying to calm myself, trying to focus? And there are playlists for focus music and relaxing music on the various streaming services. And they are not scientifically made at all. They're just a bunch of people saying, and I actually tested them, and they don't work. But I think in the what we have to look forward to is with AI over the next year or so, AI will be able to map the DNA of music more or less. And through feedback with smart devices like a smart ring or a smart watch, be able to tell what's happening to your heart rate, your respiration rate, maybe even to some extent your brain waves. And AI will be able to say, oh, Mary Beth, you're about to go skiing, and to help yourself focus and rev yourself up, here's a playlist for you.
Sure.
Or Mary Beth, you just had a fight with somebody. Your utility company gave you the wrong bill and they refused to change it and you're really upset, and here's some music that will calm you down. And it's custom designed for you, Mary Beth, because
right. It
knows what you listen to and what you like and what's going to work.
Daniel Levitin, the book is I Heard There Was a Secret Chord. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. It's an incredible book.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.